promises to keep. Turning to page 20. In spite of the inequities in the armed forces, black soldiers served their country. In preparation for World War II, the U.S. government formed a training school for black pilots. The school was located at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. The Tuskegee Airmen were the first African Americans to qualify as military pilots in any branch of the armed forces. By the end of World War II, almost 1,000 had won their wings at Tuskegee Army Airfield. Dad was in the Army for 3 years, from 1942 to 1945. Mom stayed at UCLA to get her degree. My parents were separated except for the times Dad came home on leave. My father wrote to Mom several times a week and sent a box of chocolates on Fridays. The separation was hard on both of them, but Mom believes that it helped prepare them for their life together. Dad was stationed at Fort Riley, Kansas, and Fort Hood, Texas. Because of an old football injury, he wasn't sent overseas. Instead, he was assigned to the cavalry, where, with the help of fellow soldier and boxing champion Joe Lewis, he went to officer's training school and graduated as a second lieutenant. Neither Dad's rank of second lieutenant nor his college athletic celebrity protected him against the humiliation of serving in a segregated army in the Deep South. Dad served as a morale officer, yet could do nothing about the fact that the baseball team was segregated, whereas the football team was not. One way he protested this injustice was by refusing to play any sport for the Army. Toward the end of his stint in the armed forces, my father faced Jim Crow head-on. During a bus ride from the Army base into town, the bus driver ordered my father to the back of the bus, a section for black people only. Dad ignored the command. He knew his rights as a soldier. An argument followed, and Dad was arrested. Later, he had to defend himself in military court. The charges were dismissed. On November 28, 1944, Dad was honorably discharged from the Army. A year later, America and her allies declared victory over Hitler. With the war over, attention turned to peace at home. Looking at the pictures on page 20, top left-hand side, Dad graduated from officers' training school as a second lieutenant. The picture on the bottom, the caption reads, "The Tuskegee Airmen." More than a million black men and women served in the World War II armed forces. Many black entertainers joined tours of Army camps. On the home front, black civilians worked in the war industries. Pictures on page 21, bottom. Dad was on leave from his Army base. He and Mom announced their engagement at this dance. And the top right-hand corner, August 15, 1945. U.S. Armed Service members in Paris, France, celebrate the end of World War II. Turning to page 22. 1945, a changing world. After the Army, Dad worked for a year as a coach at Huston-Tillotson College in Austin, Texas. He then played baseball in the Negro Leagues for one season, 1945. That was the only league open to an African-American ball player at the time. Between 1888 and 1947, black ball players were restricted to the Negro Leagues. The Negro Leaguers played a unique and exciting style of baseball that entertained millions in small towns and big cities across America. Negro League teams gave us great players, such as Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, Willie Mays, and Henry Hank Aaron. Despite the glory associated with Negro League baseball, it was still a part of a discriminatory system. Major League Baseball had an unwritten policy that kept non-white players out of organized baseball. Black ball players were denied the opportunity to play in the major leagues. Salaries were lower in the Negro Leagues. The schedules were less structured, and when the teams traveled south, they were forced to follow Jim Crow laws. Because of its inequities, Dad questioned his future in professional baseball. Although my dad knew that the black press, some liberal sports writers, and a few politicians were fighting for an end to Jim Crow baseball, he had little faith that it would happen in his lifetime. Little did Dad know that change was close, or that he was the prime candidate to break down the racial barrier. The end of World War II signaled a turning point in America in many ways. Segregation was one area that was certain to change. The black veterans returning from World War II were more determined than ever to abolish segregation. In 1948, President Harry S. Truman announced an end to segregation in the U.S. military. Other people were just as interested in desegregating civilian life. Some of them started with sports. Because of its significance to American culture, baseball was the first team sport targeted for change. American baseball, which grew out of British ball and stick games like cricket and rounders, gained in popularity during the Civil War. By the end of the war, baseball was considered America's pastime. It seemed to represent all that was considered good about America: democracy, teamwork, fair play, excellence. It also represented America at its worst: divided, discriminatory, unjust. Picture on page 22. Satchel Paige on the left and my father played in the Negro Leagues together. Picture on page 23. As a member of the Kansas City Monarchs, my dad played in 47 games, hitting .387 with 14 doubles, 4 triples, and 5 home runs. His strong performance won him a slot as a shortstop on the Negro League All-Star team. Turning to page 24. Determined to end institutionalized discrimination in baseball, sports writers such as Wendell Smith of the Pittsburgh Courier, Frank A. Young of the Chicago Defender, Art Cohn from the Oakland Tribune, Sam Lacy of the Baltimore Afro-Americans, and Shirley Povich of the Washington Post wrote daily articles on the injustice of segregation within professional sports. They appealed to the baseball commissioner, to the owners of teams, to the ball players themselves, and to the fans who supported the game. The questions these journalists raised went beyond the issue of race and into the economics of the game. They asked, could baseball truly be considered America's pastime when black ball players and white ball players couldn't play on the same field? Could post-World War II teams afford to rebuild and be successful without including the enormous talent pool that existed within the Negro Leagues? Could the business of baseball grow when it was being accused of racism? Could the United States really consider itself a democracy if a portion of its population were denied basic human rights and opportunities simply because of the color of their skin. Looking at the big picture on the bottom, the caption reads, "Baseball parks, like the game itself, were segregated." On page 25, a timeline. 1845. There are several myths about how and when professional baseball reached the continental United States. However, it is now commonly agreed that in 1845, the Knickerbocker Baseball Club of New York adapted the European games of the past into the game we know today as baseball. 1846. The first recorded game is played on June 19th at Elysian Fields in Hoboken, New Jersey, where the New York Knickerbockers lost to the New York Baseball Club. In 1869, the Cincinnati Red Stockings became the first openly salaried team and are considered the first professional team. 1876, the first major league, the National League, is formed in New York City. 1882, there are now two rival major baseball leagues in existence, the National League and the American Association. Neither league has any black players. 1884. Moses Fleetwood Walker from Ohio becomes the first black major leaguer when his team, the Toledo Blue Stockings of the Northwestern League, joins the American Association. 1887. White players complain that they don't want to play alongside black players. Baseball owners vote not to offer any further major league contracts to black players. 1920, the first national all-black league is formed. Turning to page 26. With the country delicately balanced toward change, and baseball under pressure to set the pace, someone within the executive ranks of baseball had to commit to breaking the color barrier. A couple of baseball owners had tried to be pioneers before 1945, but were unsuccessful. Then, with exquisite timing, Branch Rickey, president and general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, stepped forward. He was just the man for the job. Wesley Branch Rickey was born December 20th, 1881, in Stockdale, Ohio. He played baseball as a young boy in the Ohio countryside. Rickey attended Ohio Wesleyan University. Summers, he helped support himself by playing semi-pro baseball. Even as a young man, Branch Rickey had strong values and firm beliefs. For example, while a student at Ohio Wesleyan, he began playing Major League Baseball for the Cincinnati Reds in 1905. He refused to play games on Sundays because it was against his religious principles. Rickey was released from the team for taking his stand. From that point on, he had a clause written into all of his baseball contracts stating that he did not have to report to the ballparks on Sundays. After Rickey graduated from Ohio Wesleyan, he went to law school, worked as an athletic director and baseball coach, and played big league ball for the St. Louis Browns in 1906 and the New York Highlanders in 1907. In his spare time, he lectured against legalizing alcohol. Rickey went on to manage the St. Louis Browns and Cardinals, the Brooklyn Dodgers, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. In 1942, Branch Rickey was named president of the Brooklyn Dodgers. A year later, he went to the board members of the Dodger Club and told them that he wanted to recruit players from Negro League teams. The board wasn't surprised. Ricky was well known for bold moves. During World War II, he replaced seasoned baseball players who were off fighting in Europe with boys as young as 15. In the 1930s, Ricky built baseball's farm system, which today is called the minor leagues. When Ricky first proposed integrated baseball, the commissioner of baseball at the time, Judge Kennesaw Mountain Landis, was firmly against it. Landis died on November 24, 1944, and the new commissioner, A.B. Happy Chandler, took the opposite position and said, "I don't believe in barring Negroes from baseball just because they are Negroes." Branch Rickey agreed. There were two basic reasons why Branch Rickey wanted to break baseball's color line. First, he deeply believed in equality and thought it was unfair to keep black ball players out of the major leagues. Second, he wanted to build the strongest team that would win games and excite the fans. Ricky knew that the talent pool in the Negro Leagues was too tempting for a smart businessman to ignore. Branch Rickey took a year preparing to bring black ball players into the major leagues. He knew that success depended on finding the man who'd be right on and off the field. Ricky studied the field using scouts to explore the pool of players. There were many Negro League players who were well-known and proven professional baseball players. Players such as Satchel Paige and Josh Gibson certainly headed the list provided by Mr. Rickey's scouts. Branch Rickey studied the reports, listened to his scouts, and talked with black sports writers. They universally agreed, "My father not only had the ability to play on a major league level, but was the right man to pioneer the integration of major league baseball." Still, Rickey's decision was not an easy one. So, what was it that really swayed him? What convinced him to take the risk with Jackie Robinson? Looking at the picture on page 26 is a picture of Branch Rickey, and the caption reads, "Branch Rickey fought for what he believed in." And on page 27, there's a picture, and the caption reads, "Look Magazine, one of the leading magazines of its time, profiled Branch Rickey." Turning to page 28, "Why My Father." On August 28, 1945, my father, who was playing baseball for the Negro League's Kansas City Monarchs, met Branch Rickey to discuss playing for the Dodgers. There are many reports, but few eyewitnesses to this historic meeting, which took place at Branch Rickey's office in Brooklyn, New York. Ricky knew all about my father's extraordinary athletic ability and that he'd successfully played on integrated teams in college. What he didn't know much about was what kind of person my dad was. So before Ricky set up a face-to-face meeting, he called out to California to speak with people who knew my dad. He learned that Dad had been raised in a religious home by a mother whose values matched Ricky's own. He heard that Dad was a serious guy who didn't drink. He also heard that Dad was an aggressive competitor with a fiery temper. Ricky must have liked Dad's strong personality, but I'm sure he wondered how pressure would affect his playing. Nonetheless, he sent his scout, Clyde Sukeforth, out with instructions to bring Jackie Robinson to Brooklyn. According to newspapers, magazines, books, and movies, Branch Rickey and my dad eyed each other cautiously during the warm-up discussion. Rickey launched into a series of questions that were less about baseball and more about character. Did he have a girl? The Dodgers president wanted to know. Dad looked Rickey straight in the eye and explained that he was engaged and hoped to marry when he had a job. Satisfied that my father would have a supportive partner, Rickey went on to talk about the need for my dad to hold back his anger, control his impulse to strike back, and play extraordinary ball in spite of fear. My father listened carefully. He felt excited, scared, and thrilled by the opportunity to play in the big leagues. Rickey jumped into a monologue where he quickly shifted roles from that of a racist fan to a spiteful teammate. He taunted my dad with angry, mean insults. My father leaned forward, hands fisted, feet planted firmly on the floor. I can only imagine the thoughts that must have run through his mind. This was more than just a chance to play in the majors. It was a chance to avenge the racism of his boyhood, to help right injustice. Rickey was offering my father a terrific opportunity and tremendous responsibility. Dad was prepared athletically. He had the support of a loving woman and a steadfast mother. He'd matured over the years. He had his faith. But would he hold back his anger for the sake of the mission? The role-playing ceased. My father eased back in his chair, unclenched his hands, and met Branch Rickey's steely gaze with confidence and determination. Rickey asked if he could stand the pressure. Would he control his temper against verbal and even physical attacks? Dad didn't respond immediately. The same question was on his mind. He wasn't used to backing down when attacked. Rickey made it clear to my father that the first 3 years would be critical. For the sake of racial equality, he'd have to adopt a nonviolent approach to change. My father agreed. Branch Rickey knew he'd chosen the right man. He knew that Dad had both the self-control and the courage to succeed. He and my father shook hands on a verbal agreement. The noble experiment began. Pictures on page 29. Caption reads, on October 23, 1945, 2 months after meeting Branch Rickey, my father flew to Montreal to sign his contract with the Montreal Royals, the Dodgers' farm team, for a bonus of $3,500 and a salary of $600 a month. At a news conference, the Montreal Royals announced to the world that baseball's invisible color line had been broken. The bottom picture, caption reads, the three-hour meeting between my dad and Branch Rickey is legendary. Turning to page 30. Play ball. 4 months after Dad signed with the Montreal Royals, my parents got married. The Reverend Carl Downs performed the ceremony on February 10, 1946, at the Independent Church of Christ in Los Angeles. My mother's mother, Zelie Isom, was thrilled to plan the entire wedding right down to selecting Mom's china, silver, and crystal. It was wartime, so materials were hard to find. Still, Zili insisted that my mother wear a satin dress. So Mom went to Saks Fifth Avenue and found a pre-war satin sample wedding dress that had a long train. Dad matched Mom's elegance in a sharp pair of formal wear as they pledged a lifetime of love and shared dreams. 18 days later, my parents began the long trek across the country so that Dad could report to the Royals training camp in Daytona Beach, Florida. Branch Rickey had broken his own rule about not having wives at spring training and had invited my mother to join Dad. When Dad and Mom arrived in New Orleans, they were forced to give up their seats on the plane. Then they were bumped from the next two flights. To add to the humiliation, they quickly discovered that because they were now in the heart of the South, they couldn't eat in the coffee shop. Luckily, Maylee, a Southerner, had anticipated trouble and had packed my parents a lunch. 12 hours later, Mom and Dad flew from New Orleans to Pensacola, where they took a segregated bus to Daytona Beach, Florida. It was a rough start, and shades of things to come. My father joined black pitcher Johnny Wright and 200 white players from the Royals' practice. Eager newspaper reporters from New York, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, Montreal, and Brooklyn fired questions at the two black men. "What are you going to do if the pitchers start throwing at you?" "Duck," Dad joked. "Would you like to play for the Dodgers?" "Do you think you're good enough to play with Brooklyn now?" Dad answered confidently. He told the reporters that he'd played with white players before and was sure he'd make it through the minor leagues and onto the Brooklyn Dodgers team. After practice, the white players went to the Mayfair Hotel. My parents, Johnny Wright, and black sports writers Billy Rowe and Wendell Smith were housed in the black community, either in a motel or a private home. They ate their meals in black restaurants. Through it all, Mom and Dad were inseparable. Picture on the bottom page of page 30. The caption reads, "My parents believed that marriage was the most important and fulfilling commitment that adults could make. Together, they reached for this ideal." Pictures on page 31, top right-hand corner. Dad fields questions from reporter Wendell Smith on the left during spring training. And the picture on the bottom right-hand side of page 31. Caption reads, "Dad and Mom board a bus, heading for the Montreal Royals spring training in Daytona, Florida." Turning to page 32 and 33. The day after they arrived, the Royals traveled south to Sanford, Florida, for a week of spring training. As it turned out, Sanford was less welcoming than Daytona Beach. A few days into the training, Wendell Smith and Billy Rowe rushed my parents and Johnny Wright out of town because of threatened violence. Dejected, Dad said he wondered if the same thing would happen in the next town. The Royals moved their practice back to Daytona Beach and had no further problems until they played games in Jacksonville and DeLand, Florida. The Royals' front office finally had to switch their remaining games back to Daytona Beach. During games, proud black fans crowded into the Jim Crow, or segregated, section of the stands, while curious white fans filled in the remaining seats. On the field, the Royals' black players and white players worked as a team. When the game ended, they returned to their separate worlds. After a successful spring training, the integrated Montreal Royals took to the field at Roosevelt Stadium in Jersey City, New Jersey, for the start of the 1946 season. Opening day was April 14, 1946. There were 35,000 excited fans in attendance. Because school was closed, there were a lot of kids in the stands. It was a clear, sunny, brisk day. More a football kind of day than baseball. Vendors sold coffee to keep the crowd warm. The mood was electric as the mayor paraded on the field with celebrities and players for the singing of the Star Spangled Banner. Dad hit a home run in the third inning with two men on, singled three times, and stole two bases. Montreal won the game 14-1. The fans mobbed Dad afterward, asking for autographs and wishing him well. After the Jersey City opener, the Royals headed to Montreal, Canada. My parents were pleasantly surprised by the warmth and friendliness shown to them by the French Canadians. The picture that dominates page 32 is a love letter, and the caption reads, "What I love about my parents' letters is that they always began with darling." The picture on page 33, the caption reads, "Dad said he got a kick out of hearing the announcers at Montreal's stadium call his name out in French. He said it helped him escape the pressure of being Jackie Robinson. For that split second, he imagined himself to be just the new Montreal second baseman." Turning to page 34 and 35. The Royals had different experiences in each city they played. Syracuse, New York, was worse than Sanford, Florida. During one game, while my father stood in the batter's box, a Syracuse player tossed a black cat toward him yelling, "Hey Jackie, here's your cousin clowning on the field." Years later, Dad told me he had been furious, but that he had responded by smacking the ball for a double. A few moments later, a base hit sent him home with the winning run. As Dad rounded third base, he shouted to the players on the Syracuse bench, "I guess that relative of mine is happy now, isn't he?" In Baltimore, Maryland, the Royals learned there had been letters and calls threatening violence and a boycott if my father appeared on the field. The Montreal Royals played as scheduled. There were 3,415 people at the first game of the series. The small crowd was tense and angry. But as the Montreal and Baltimore series continued, the audience's mood changed. My father stole home during one game. The fans gave him a standing ovation. Dad was big news when he got some big news himself. Mom announced she was pregnant. Dad was on the road, but Mom couldn't wait for him to come home. She called Dad, thrilled to report that they were going to have their first baby. Dad was so sure his firstborn would be a boy that he later wrote back a joyous letter adding that he would make his son proud of him. Dad made good on that promise. During his one season with Montreal, he won the batting championship with a .349 average, scored 113 runs, ranked second in the league in stolen bases, and was voted most valuable player in the International League. The Montreal Royals won the pennant and the Little League World Series. Today, the 1946 World Series are regarded as one of the greatest teams in the history of minor league baseball. The picture on the left-hand side of page 34 are threatening letters. And the caption reads, "Threatening letters were mailed to our home, but so were baskets of fan mail." And the picture that dominates page 35, the caption reads, "Despite the threats on his life and the weight of a people on his shoulders, Dad completed his first year with the Montreal Royals as a most valuable player, MVP. Turning to page 36 and 37. Mom left Montreal with her 8th month of pregnancy to return to Los Angeles to wait for the birth of their first child. Dad joined her as soon as the season ended. True to his prediction, they had a boy. Jack Roosevelt Jr. was born November 18, 1946. He was a gorgeous baby with a head full of curly black hair. Mom and Dad stayed on the West Coast, surrounded by family and friends until Dad had to report for the Royals' spring training. Despite my father's success in 1946, however, it looked as though yet another Major League Baseball season would start without a black player on any team's roster. Then, on April 10, 1947, less than a week before the official opening of baseball season, the Brooklyn Dodgers played the Montreal Royals in the last game of the exhibition season. Dad hit into a double play in the 6th inning. Right after that play, a history-making announcement was made. The Brooklyn Dodgers had purchased my dad's contract from the Montreal Royals. Dad trotted back to the dugout. Fans and teammates cheered. Jackie Robinson was going to the majors. Jim Crow was going down. 5 days later, Dad played his first major league game at Ebbets Field, the Dodgers Stadium in Brooklyn, New York. An exuberant crowd watched the Dodgers beat the Boston Braves 5-3. My father played first base and went hitless that game, but later that week belted out his first major league home run when the Dodgers played the New York Giants at the Polo Grounds. Pictures on page 36, top left-hand corner. Mom holds my brother Jackie Jr. while Dad shares in the parenting. And the bottom picture. The caption reads, "When he was on base, Dad studied the outfield. He knew exactly what had to happen in order for him to successfully steal a base." And the picture that dominates page number 37, the caption reads, "Dad crosses home plate to score his first major league home run." Turning to page 38 and 39. While Dad's teammates grew to appreciate his contribution to the team, they ignored him off the field. For the first couple of months with the Dodgers, Dad stayed to himself or with one of the black sports writers. He said he felt the loneliness most when the team traveled. By June, however, things had changed. The team warmed up to my father. On train rides, they invited him to join in their card games. Eventually, Dad felt comfortable joking around with the other players. The bottom of page 38 picture with the caption reading, "Dad used to say that it didn't matter if somebody resents you. It only mattered if you could make him respect you." 2 months into his first major league season, my father's skill gained him the respect of his teammates and the fans. That's my dad, number 42, with the Dodgers captain Pee Wee Reese, number 1. The picture that dominates page 39. The caption reads, "Here's how my mother remembered those early major league years. During Jack's baseball career, I attended every home game. I wanted to be with him and to experience his world. After games, I talked about how it felt to sit in the stands and hear fans yell at my husband. Jack talked about how hard it was to hold back his anger. Together, we fought off pessimism and despair. We worked hard to keep our fighting spirits alive and alert. We laughed and cried together. Most importantly, Jack was neither a victim nor a martyr, as some have characterized him. We had many triumphs and victories to celebrate during his lifetime. Turning to page 40 and 41. White fan reaction may have been mixed, but there was nothing ambiguous about the support from the Brooklyn fans and from African American communities across the country. They loved my dad. Black families traveled long distances to go to ballparks to see him play. They gathered around radios at a neighbor's home to cheer Dad on. Sports writer Sam Lacy once wrote, "No matter what the nature of the gathering, a horse race, a church meeting, a ball game, the universal question is, how'd Jackie make out today?" My parents and Jackie Jr. settled into a small home in Brooklyn, surrounded by a community that embraced them. There, they met lifelong friends. As the baseball season progressed, Mom became friendly with a couple of the Dodgers' spouses, such as Gil Hodges' wife, Joan, and Pee Wee Reese's wife, Dottie. About a month into the 1947 season, the Dodgers were in Cincinnati, Ohio, playing the Reds. The mood in the stadium was tense. Some of the fans started yelling at Dodger captain Pee Wee Reese, telling him that, as a Southerner, he shouldn't be playing ball with a black man. Reese heard the shouting but refused to even glance in the direction of the stands. Instead, he walked over to my dad on first base. Reese put his hand on my father's shoulder and started talking to him. His words weren't important. In fact, afterward, neither man remembered what was said. It was the gesture of comradeship and support that counted. As the two teammates stood talking, the fans got the message. They stopped heckling and settled down to watch the game. From that day forward, Pee Wee and my dad were friends, and they worked well together as teammates for many years. The picture on the bottom of page 40, the caption reads, "Mom attended most of the Dodgers' home games. My brother Jackie Jr. went to many of those games with her." And the picture on the bottom of page 41, Dad and Pee Wee Reese warm up with some stretches. Page 42 and 43. Major League Baseball players on other teams had mixed reactions to integration. Even late into the 1947 season, opposing players struck Dad with their cleats or even pitched the ball at him, hoping to start a fight. Dad contained his anger. He glared at his aggressor until he had gathered the strength not to throw a punch. The Brooklyn Dodgers won the pennant in 1947, but lost the World Series to the New York Yankees. By the end of Dad's first official year in the majors, his record spoke for itself. My father led the league in stolen bases and in sacrifice bunts and was second in runs scored. He played in 151 of the 154 games that first season, all at first base, and brought a new aggressive style to the game. The Sporting News and the Baseball Writers Association named Dad Outstanding Rookie of the Year in honor of his hitting, running, defensive play, and value to his team. He was the first winner of this award. Picture on page 42, four snapshots, but the caption reads, "Dad gets hit by a pitch." Picture on page 43, on the upper right-hand side, Dad accepts his 1947 Rookie of the Year award. And on the bottom, the caption reads, "Dodger fans celebrate their team's 1947 pennant win." Page 44 and 45. During the offseason, a group of black New York City fans organized a Jackie Robinson Day at Ebbets Field. They presented my father with a new Cadillac, a television set, and other gifts. Dad's fame made him a popular guest on radio shows. In October 1947, he signed a contract for his autobiography that was to be written by Wendell Smith. That same year, a public opinion poll named my father the second most popular man in America. Actor and singer Bing Crosby was the most popular. 2 years into Dad's major league career, Mom found out that she was pregnant with me. She hoped for a girl. In anticipation of a growing family, my parents moved from Brooklyn to St. Albans, Queens. When I arrived on January 13, 1950, she and Dad were thrilled. My timing was impeccable. It was off-season for baseball and just before Dad had to go to Los Angeles for the filming of the motion picture, The Jackie Robinson Story. The picture on the bottom of page 44, the caption reads, "My father's excellence on the field, his winning personality, and good looks made him one of the most photographed black personalities of the time. Sports writers, black and white, covered his every move." The picture on the bottom of page 45, the caption reads, "Kids with 10 cents could find out all about my dad and this popular comic book published in 1949. And the upper right-hand corner of page 45, the picture, the caption reads, "Dad, Jackie Jr., and me."